Paul Rodel here again, IVS Oral History Project. Today is August 21st, and I'm sitting in the home of Gordon and also Shirley Brockmuller. And normally I wouldn't say the spouse's name, but there's something different here, and that even though Shirley was never listed officially as an IVS volunteer, in fact, she and Gordon went together. So she was there all the while, worked as a teacher of English, and shared a lot of these same experiences. So I'm going to include her in some of the questions and some of the discussions. Now, Gordon himself, and, well, of course, Shirley, because you were with, you know, first went to Vietnam in 1957, stayed until 1961. During that time, a couple of years, I guess, first 2 years as the volunteer, mm-hmm. and then after that, chief of party for mm-hmm. a couple of years, then back to the United States, and serving in IVS Washington for 3 years, basically 62 to 65, about 3 years, 2.5, 3, something.
That's right.
As personnel and program office. So, with that as the introduction, I'll ask you the first question that we ask everybody, and that is, what is it about, well, first of all, just where were you born, when were you born, what were your parents like, how did they raise the young Gordon, and what was it in your childhood, youth, leading up to IVS that got you interested in that kind of service, even before you might have heard of the organization? And while you start, Shirley can think of her answer.
Well, it's not an easy question to answer.
I know. It usually is the longest one.
Yeah. But I was born right here in this house.
Oh.
In 1934.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up on the farm. Had a rather close family. Typical, probably, Midwestern rural family. My parents went through the depression years,
mm-hmm.
the drought of the 1930s. I don't remember anything really specifically about it, except what they related. And it certainly influenced their lives a great deal. I suppose that the thing that got me interested in working abroad, even before I heard about IVS or Peace Corps or any of the other service organizations, is that this community, being a strong Mennonite community.
You mean Freeman?
Yeah, Freeman community, East Freeman community, the Mennonite community had a very strong service orientation,
mm-hmm.
and we had people come in to speak to us who had been with the Mennonite Central Committee, primarily at In the early years that I remember, they were doing relief work in Europe after World War II,
mm-hmm.
and so they would come back and tell of their experiences, and also we would have missionaries and voluntary service people that would come back from other countries, and I think that's where I begin to get interested in maybe doing some sort of service abroad. Now, how I got into IVS specifically is that again, because of my Mennonite background, I was a conscientious objector. Mm-hmm. And when I was classified and drafted, my draft board was looking for an assignment for me, and they had talked about hospital work, hospital orderly work,
right,
in the United States, and there was a place at Hot Springs, South Dakota, and a place somewhere else, and I was not really interested in that sort of an experience, and I heard about some of the work that some of the Mennonite boys were doing with the Mennonite Central Committee in Europe,
mm-hmm,
and also in Mexico, and that it was also accepted as alternate service work. So I had communications with MCC, and I had asked whether they might have a place for me in Mexico. And the executive secretary of MCC, who was a man by the name of William Snyder, also served on the IVS board.
Mm-hmm.
This was in the very early days when IVS was just being organized. And since I had a degree in agriculture, most of the alternate service people that the Mennonite Central Committee sent out were involved with building projects, and they were not necessarily people with agricultural backgrounds. But since I had a university degree in agriculture, and he was associated with IVS, he was interested in getting some Mennonites out with IVS.
Especially with ag.
And so they started talking Vietnam to me, and I would go back and say, Mexico, please. And it's embarrassing, but we didn't know where Vietnam was.
Yeah, well, I don't
and
know.
And neither did anybody else, you know. And so anyway, they encouraged me to be part of this team that they were sending to Vietnam, and they made the arrangements with the Selective Service so that mm-hmm. it would serve as volunteer as an alternate service. And so we agreed to go to Vietnam, and when we told people we were going to Vietnam, I mean, invariably they'd say, "Where's that?"
Yeah. You know?
So we would say, "Well, have you heard of Indochina?"
Uh-huh.
"Well, China, but
yeah,
Indochina." It's amazing, but it's true. Vietnam was not a household word in those days.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nobody knew where it was. But we got books to read, and we got information from IVS Washington, and we became quite excited about going to Vietnam. And you probably know the makeup of that first team. There were, I think, seven of us about that flew over. Basically in agriculture, we had a nurse, and then Tom went over as a forester.
Mm-hmm. Well, just to be sure, can you remember who was in that group?
Oh, yeah, I would know. Orzella Bailey, Zoom.
Okay.
She married Chi's brother.
Yes, okay, I heard that, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
She was the nurse.
Is she still alive?
No.
I didn't think so.
No, she passed away prematurely from what? Cancer, I believe.
Oh.
Well, Tom,
I thought yeah, that she had died. Yeah.
Tom Lucci was the forester.
Mm-hmm.
Art King, who also has passed away,
mm-hmm.
Was also in animal husbandry and in livestock production. Bill Shawley, who did not finish out his 2 years.
Oh.
And did not really enjoy the work there very much.
Mm-hmm.
And us. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
That went over initially. Tom, Art, Arzella, Bill, you and myself. I think that's it.
Okay.
Okay, so that's sort of how I found out about IVS too was that they're at South Dakota State University. They had little flyers up on the bulletin board.
Uh-huh.
And I read a little bit of the promotion on that, and I was intrigued by that. So I had already had a little bit of an idea what IVS was all about.
This is even before the fellow at MCC
was talking to you about it. Yeah.
Okay.
It had caught my eye, and I was kind of intrigued by it,
mm-hmm.
by the organization and by its concepts and the fact that it the thing that appealed to me about IVS was that it was an organization that was motivated by Christian principles, but was not denominational,
mm-hmm.
and not an organization that did religious proselytizing,
mm-hmm.
but that the impetus or the motivation came from the Christian service angle,
mm-hmm. And for humanitarian rather than religious.
Yes, yeah. And that really appealed to me.
Okay, and your primary motivation though was, or I'd say, conditioning factor was the church and its ethic of service.
Yeah, yeah. And I will say that, you know, selective service played a part.
Uh-huh.
I may have gone otherwise,
mm-hmm.
but it certainly held my feet to the fire.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, I think there's in all of us that probably served with IVS and other organizations, there are different motivations that we have and different reasons, or various reasons, I should say, that play a part in our going, and that certainly was initially was one, mm-hmm. one reason.
Okay. No, it's strong reasons, compelling.
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, they would bring these people in from many places across the planet, and as a young person, you're hearing this, getting intrigued by it. So
uh-huh.
it sounds like a much better deal than bedpans.
Yes.
I mean,
that
doesn't take too much to figure out.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
Between cleaning bedpans and going off across the world,
exactly.
I think there's no question.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. And I Shirley, how about yourself?
Well, I
pretty much
I,
the same thing, you know.
No, I came from a different background than Gordon. I grew up in Seattle, and there was never any thought in my mind about going overseas.
Really?
No, heavens no.
But well, you've certainly been overseas a lot.
Yeah. I guess being a newlywed, I would have followed Gordon around the world, and that's what I did.
Yeah, that's precisely what you did.
Well, literally.
Literally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But for me, the first year was very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
We had told Dr. Nofsinger that
he was the executive secretary at the time,
and he asked us not to raise a family.
Mm.
And we said no. We wouldn't. But little did we know that I was pregnant when we left.
Uh-oh.
Oh, and I was very ill the first months. I couldn't, when, after we arrived, you know, we were in Saigon several weeks, and then the group went up country to Halan.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't able to go along because I was too ill.
Yeah.
And I had to stay in Saigon with some secretary or with a Yusong secretary. And I was very young, what was it, about 20 or mm-hmm. I don't know. And I was always sheltered and protected, you know, mm-hmm. growing up. So there was a lot of adjustments to make for me.
Yeah.
And then when I felt better, then I was able to go up country. And since I wasn't part of the team,
mm-hmm.
I was supposed to earn my way going and coming. So after I started feeling better, I went back to Saigon and I worked teaching English to young military students who were planning to study in the United States.
Ah, okay. Prepare them well enough for the,
yes,
for the classroom.
Uh-huh,
yeah,
uh-huh.
Yeah.
And I had to rent a flat and live by myself. I didn't know the language. I was pregnant. It was a very, very difficult time.
Oh, wow.
Tell him the story about the money. Maybe he, well, it's okay to be on tape, I guess.
Okay. We had to pay 6 months advance rent for this little studio apartment where I was going to live.
Uh-huh.
In Saigon.
Yeah.
And we had to borrow the money. There was a Mennonite group in Saigon who agreed to lend us, it was quite a sum of money.
Yeah. 6 months rent.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
They were going to lend us that money. So that's the only way I could stay. I get nervous just talking about it.
Why? Because it was so tentative? Or?
No, because I almost lost the money. I was you know how the shops are along the streets and
yeah.
the street vendors, and I needed to have some maternity clothes made
uh-huh.
because you don't go buy off the rack, you know.
Right, yeah.
And I had all this money plus the key to the flat in my purse, and I set the purse down beside me, and you know, I wanted to feel the material.
Yeah.
And then I looked, and my purse was gone.
Oh,
oh, did I ever panic. I didn't know what
Jeez.
To do.
Yes.
And, you know, the streets were teeming with people. And
it's the open market.
Yeah.
So I started kind of running down the street to see if I could see anybody carrying my purse. And then all of a sudden, from behind me, came somebody. It was a policeman. Madame, madame, he said. And he handed me my purse.
He caught him.
I don't know. I couldn't communicate.
Oh,
well, apparently.
Yeah.
And all the money was in there.
Yeah.
Wow.
So.
Oh, wow. No
that
wonder
was,
you still get nervous.
Yeah. Oh,
it wasn't just
you.
About running into debt.
No.
Oh man.
Well, and we had no money at all in those mm-hmm. days. I mean, of our own, we were just out of school and. And, you know, I'd never had any chance to earn money, and then going with IVS.
You weren't being given any.
We weren't being given any, so we were just being taken care of, and that was it. So we didn't have a lot of cushion to pay something like that back, so it was a good reason why she panicked.
Oh yeah, no, I understand perfectly. Just perfectly clear. But when Gordon comes in and says, "Guess what, dear?" what did you say?
You mean that we were going to go overseas?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't think it could happen.
You were just didn't want to believe it. Oh, this isn't going to happen. It's just sort of a harebrained scheme again.
Just, yeah.
Okay. So but you met in college then?
No. That's a long story.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, all right.
My parents were originally from this community too.
Oh, okay. So So were you raised Mennonite?
No, no, although...
You were from, they were from this town, but not from the Mennonite community.
Yes, my dad was Mennonite, but my mother was not Mennonite. They couldn't compromise, so the way they compromised was to join a different denomination.
All together?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And then my folks left here when I was 6 weeks old.
Uh-huh.
In fact, they lived just about a mile
away.
Yeah.
And I met Gordon when, I think the first time when I was about 12 years old.
Her folks came back here for a visit.
Uh-huh.
And since they were friends with my parents, they got together and then...
So you guys got together, but as little kids. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then there were several other visits.
Yeah, yeah, all those other things, yeah.
Yeah. When we were 16, then we kind of eyeing each other.
Yeah, that was in a different way
the
from 12.
Chemistry started to work, but, you know.
Oh, man.
But
that
things did get better after I came nearer to the time when the baby was going to be born. I went up to Palan and was able to be with Gordon. And they had a leprosarium outside of Bon Mituit. I don't know how many kilometers that was.
Oh, it was a couple hours drive, but it wasn't too that far, but it was, you know, those roads.
Yeah, the roads and the conditions wouldn't.
Yeah.
And this leprosarium was staffed by two Mennonite doctors.
Uh-huh.
And also some people from the Christian Missionary Alliance.
So you decided to have the child there?
I had it at a leprosarium.
Oh my.
And then from then on.
And this is the daughter that just ran the Boston Marathon?
No, that's Lee, the oldest.
Okay, that's right. Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, because she was the baby.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Yes.
The one that's going to Cambodia.
Right.
And through this doctor's help, you know, I thought I was going to have to go home, but he said, we can make it, we can do it, and he helped a lot with a lot of moral support. And
The other thing that helped, too, is that you enjoyed the English teaching. You know, it felt like you were really...
I felt I was an expert. You know, and that's all you needed to be was a native speaker, and you were an expert.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it was really good for my ego, in a way, you know.
But also just doing something for somebody who appreciated it.
Yeah, I didn't have a college degree, but yet I was able to do something worthwhile.
Yeah.
And I had, after we left Halong, we moved to Bon Mituit, and I had students come to the house, so I was able to teach on the balcony.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. And you
know,
might have been the first real education volunteer.
You know how the Asians are. They're so gracious and so flowery and thankful, and you really had a good class there to work with.
And I had good material from the Vietnamese American Association. Out of Saigon, which was very helpful.
So you didn't really have to prepare from scratch and all of that.
Mm-hmm. I had good material.
Excellent. I'm glad you made that adjustment.
Yeah, it was difficult, but once I even learned to like Nukmam after the first 2 years.
It didn't take me that long, but still, you know.
Yeah. Well, see, that was one thing that bothered her really when she first got there is those smells.
Uh-huh.
You can imagine being just a month pregnant and all those strange smells.
Most people gain weight. I lost 20 pounds the first months in Vietnam.
Yeah. It just didn't like it.
But then after that, you know, I was able to stay with the team, and things went much better.
Now, if you were teaching English, you wouldn't have to be too concerned about learning the local language.
Mm-mm.
But Gordon, on the other hand, you would have had a need for Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
How well did your Vietnamese go in terms of what instruction did they give you, and what kind of proficiency were you able to reach, especially because you were married and didn't have to maybe use it as frequently? It's more barriers to overcome.
Yeah, we had pretty good instruction when we lived in the village of Halong.
Okay.
We had, initially we had three interpreters that went out with us, translators, who also served as English teachers. And
English teachers?
Vietnamese teachers.
Yeah, okay.
So we would spend several hours a day on language, and then be able to use it right along while we were learning formally. I wouldn't say that my abilities in learning language were great compared to some of the others. But I
some people just naturally have a proficiency.
That's right. I mean, I
hate them.
I struggled with it.
I struggled with it,
and the Vietnamese is not an easy language to learn. And later on, when I worked with, I worked with AID then in North Africa.
Later on,
and I learned French and. To me, that was much easier to learn.
My
proficiency level there was much higher
than
it ever was in Vietnamese. But I was able to function without a translator.
How long did that take?
I would say about a year.
It's not bad.
About a year.
Yeah.
That where I felt quite comfortable.
Yeah, I mean, you're not discussing philosophy, but you're getting through the day.
That's right. Yeah,
and dealing with people in the way that you have to.
Yeah, like
and the common pleasantries and et cetera.
What happened to the chickens that you were raising?
What chickens?
why are there two less than there should be?
You have to ask, huh? So. You just mentioned the chickens, and that's what you were doing.
I worked
there.
With chickens. That's right, and there again, you know how with these organizations they sort of give you a position, and you kind of make of it what you can.
Yeah.
I never had as much training in chickens as I did in some of the other things, but they didn't have anybody else to fill that slot, and there was a job for somebody to work with chickens, and so I enjoyed the work with the chickens.
Well, what was it you were actually doing? Introducing America, or what? And what was the need?
Okay. In the villages, all the villages there. They raise chickens.
Yes.
And they're, I suppose, in all of the Asian countries, they're pretty much the same.
Free range.
Free range, kind of a tough, scrawny, vigorous bird. And that's they had them in the villages of Vietnam. What we did was we brought in chickens. I believe it was either the Philippines or from Taiwan. I mean, they were American stock, probably English stock initially, but we would call them American stock, like New Hampshire Reds and that sort. And we would get them in. And give them to village people to raise, and we had a
But these chickens already were sort of acclimatized to Asia because they were actually,
yes,
the eggs were laid, yeah, and then hatched in Asia.
Yeah,
they grew up.
They either, I can't remember if they came, they came either from Taiwan or the Philippines.
Yeah.
But they, we would talk to village people and sort of set forth the criteria that would qualify them for getting some chickens. And the main thing is they had to build a little hutch for them, a little house for them. They were not
no more free range.
No more free range. And so the first ones, we hired someone from the village to build a little bamboo chicken hut, and it was up on stilts,
mm-hmm,
and it was a kind of woven bamboo,
mm-hmm,
and had a thatch roof on it, much like the houses.
Yeah.
And had little doors on it, and for feeders there was split bamboo,
mm-hmm,
running horizontally on the,
sure,
outside of the pen, and they would stick their heads through and eat, and the other side have a little bamboo trough and be water in there, and we put the chickens in there, and we said if you build a hut like that, and commit yourself to taking care of them. And there were other things that they had to agree to do. We would provide them with, I think it was 10 chickens,
mm-hmm,
per family, or five. So incredibly, huts started going up all over the village.
Really?
And they would improvise on our design.
Uh-huh.
And they were fancy. I mean,
almost a,
you
contest.
Know, like a cathedral chicken house.
Wow.
And we got all kinds of requests for chickens.
Uh-huh.
And we were able to fill these, and it really
That's
was
good,
quite
because
a
I was just thinking. Yeah.
Quite a successful project. They knew how to raise chickens. I mean, they were familiar with chickens.
Yeah.
It didn't take them long to see that that these chickens had a lot more meat on them.
Mm-hmm.
And occasionally they would jump the gun and eat the chickens before they were ready. Or we had some other problems. Catholic Relief Service was very strong in those villages, and they would in their relief program would have cornmeal and powdered milk and cheese, and a lot of times this was the diet the chickens were fed.
Were thrived on.
The cornmeal. Cheese, the people didn't have much use for cheese, so chickens ate it. And
any bulgur wheat?
We didn't have bulgur there.
Oh.
But
that's good pig feed.
Yeah, it would have been the same story.
Yeah.
I can remember one occasion where we had an order of a big amount of chickens scheduled to come in, and they would come to Saigon, and then they would come by truck,
mm-hmm,
out to the village, and it was during the rainy season, and it was pouring, and the truck got stuck on one of those roads, and somebody, you know, ran to the village and advised us that they needed help. They were stuck there with the chickens, we got within maybe several miles of where they were with our vehicle, and we walked along this muddy road, pouring rain. Picked these chickens, came up in boxes, you know, just like they ship chickens anywhere, cardboard boxes. Carried these chickens up like this, walked down the road, and transferred them to our vehicle and took them to the village. I can remember I was walking along in the mud.
I can picture what's going to happen.
Chickens on my head, thinking, what in the world am I doing here? And all of a sudden it occurred to me that on top of that, it was on a Sunday, and it was my birthday.
Oh, no.
And here I was walking with chickens on my head and knee-deep in mud.
Was this cardboard box solid on the bottom?
Well, it was, but it was
okay, because if it was
soaking
porous,
through a little.
Well, you know, the chickens might have been doing something on you.
Yeah, well, that probably happened too.
That would have just been perfect. Well, you know, I just realized something. I didn't ask you, I know who the people were there,
uh-huh.
But I've got to ask you for the tape. Who were the people that you were working with?
Okay, these were...
And what was this community?
These were refugees, mm-hmm. that came down from North Vietnam at the time when the agreement was made to divide the country into after Dien Bien Phu.
Yeah.
And
so this would have been they're coming down in 55, 56.
Yes.
In that breathing space.
Yes, that's right, in the breathing space, mm-hmm. that the arrangement permitted them,
right.
to leave. And they were primarily Catholic villagers that came as an entire village from the north with their priest,
mm-hmm.
and settled as a village in the highlands of South Vietnam.
And really just resettled.
Resettled. And they were given land,
mm-hmm.
and they were given funds to settle in that area. And they were Vietnamese did not want to move to the highlands because they were more familiar with the lowland rice paddy type of,
mm-hmm.
of lifestyle, and also they were afraid of the jungle area. They literally had a clear jungles to build their villages. So they gave them some good incentives to resettle there. And
to overcome this reluctance.
Oh, to overcome this reluctance, yes.
Yeah.
And the other thing is they settled among some of the tribal people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in the area where there were tribal people. And there was a little bit of apprehension in that regard.
On whose part?
Well, on both parts. I mean, because...
All around.
Yeah, because the relationship between the Vietnamese and the tribal people had never been close.
Right. I mean, right.
It changed somewhat in later years, but at that time there was a lot of apprehension on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
The tribal people were afraid that the Vietnamese were coming in and moving in, taking their territory.
Yeah.
And the Vietnamese were physically afraid of the tribal people because of their lifestyle and their preconceived ideas of them being savages.
Right, right.
So in fact, the word for them in both the French and in the Vietnamese is a savage. So mm-hmm. they certainly had that in mind. But really, they got along fairly well.
As it turns out.
As it turned out.
Yeah.
Yes.
What do you know?
Yes.
And they didn't get along well with savages.
They did not have a whole lot to do with each other.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't bother each other either, and they did some trading, and they got along, I think, better than they anticipated.
And the refugees you mentioned were supported by the government.
They were supported by the government, by the church.
Mm-hmm.
The Catholic Church at large, and also Catholic Relief Services
from
the
from
United
over,
States.
Yeah, okay.
And also through the USAID program.
Mm-hmm. And the Vietnamese government, especially because they were Catholic.
Especially, yeah.
I mean, with Diem being
yes,
a devout Catholic
yes.
and his bishop brother.
Exactly.
But
yeah.
You also mentioned that there were a couple of villages in the area that you worked with that were, a couple of them were not Catholic.
That's right. There were Buddhist, a couple of Buddhist villages who also settled as a village from the north
mm-hmm.
with the Buddhist priest. And then we also worked with some of the tribal villages in the same way.
Okay.
We worked with maybe 10-12 villages in the area. The closest were with the two villages that lived on either side of us,
mm-hmm.
because of our proximity to
of
them.
Of course, yeah.
But then after about a year, weren't we in that village about a year? Then we moved into a group home in Ben Matuit.
Group home?
Well, it was kind of a hotel or a, we lived as a group.
Mm.
IVS lived as a group in a.
All of you original people.
Yes.
Who came together. Oh.
Yes. We left the village,
mm-hmm.
and it was mainly because working in that number of villages and living in Ha Long, it was difficult to. We just spent so much time getting from one village to the other because of the, especially during the rainy season, because
uh-huh.
of the roads. The roads were atrocious.
Yeah.
And so we moved into a house in Ben Matuit, which was the province seat of Ben Matuit province,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And continued to work with those villages. And then later on, we built an experimental demonstration area in the Ben Matuit area in the Ben Matuit province,
mm-hmm.
close to the town of Ben Matuit, and from there then we worked out into those villages.
How did the chicken distribution go? I mean, a lot of the little chicken palaces
yeah.
were built.
It's a good program. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it was a simple, very simple program, and very. Very trouble-free.
Okay.
Chickens did well.
They did. Okay.
Chickens did well. For the most part, they took care of them well.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't work as closely with it, but another guy worked similarly with the pig program. And
Who was that?
That was Art King.
Okay.
And he also brought over some pigs
mm-hmm.
of improved breeds, and did some crossbreeding, and that also went pretty well,
uh-huh.
because again, it was something that they knew how to take care of pigs, and they were willing to
learn a little bit more for the special variety.
It seemed like they were really interested in improving both the chickens and the pigs.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Another fellow worked with garden seeds, introducing some better varieties of vegetables, and then the nurse worked with public health. She had probably had the most problems.
You mean for the job or adjustment?
The job.
Okay.
And I think that's probably somewhat normal in development work, that when you're working in another country in the field of public health,
mm-hmm.
there can be more problems because the local nurses and medical people
mm-hmm.
Are sometimes threatened by somebody else coming in,
mm-hmm.
be it the local nurse at the infirmary or the witch doctor or whoever
mm-hmm.
it is.
Mm-hmm.
And so there, I would say the most problems came through the health program. But the agriculture program, it was very simple.
Mm-hmm. I
mean, and in retrospect, it was quite sound in that even though we brought in new varieties and new breeds, they had been tested in other Asian countries, as you had mentioned earlier, and they seem to adapt well.
Now it's just that its importance.
Yeah.
Hit me when
yeah.
you were saying that the chickens came from,
uh-huh.
you know, within the region, no matter what country,
yeah.
they
yeah.
would have had some acclimatization.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly.
With temperature and parasites
yeah.
and water supply
yeah.
and
yeah.
all this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that just suddenly made much more rational sense.
Yeah.
Because I talked to somebody who was very early in Laos, and that was disastrous in terms of where they were going to bring in some Brahma bulls and
uh-huh.
all this other stuff.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Because the area had been surveyed, you know, looked at it, in other words,
uh-huh.
During the rainy season when everything was lush, and they said, oh, it's just like the plains, and let's bring in all of our stuff here, and then everything died, you know,
uh-huh.
no
yeah.
water or anything,
yeah.
you know, whereas
yeah.
you're just taking something that's already there and making an incremental improvement.
Yes, yeah.
That has a much better chance of survival. So your safety must have been pretty secure. I mean, this is a bunch of Catholics who hated the North,
uh-huh.
who weren't going to let any kind of dissident come within
uh-huh.
their village,
uh-huh.
and were going to take care of you too. Did you feel very secure and safe?
Very secure.
Mm-hmm.
Very secure. In fact, we did a lot of tromping around in the jungle area. I mean, that was just, you know, jungle,
yeah,
forest. And did some hunting.
Mm-hmm. Catch any big game?
Yeah, tiger.
Mm-hmm.
You saw it.
Yeah, I saw it on the wall upstairs. I just called it Hobbs, you know, Calvin
yeah,
and Hobbs.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean the security was good. You knew that there was, you know, that there were some dissenters in the jungles,
mm-hmm.
but we weren't really concerned about our safety.
It was more to the south.
Yeah.
South of Saigon.
Yeah, toward
in the delta.
And
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Certainly in our first 2 years in Vietnam, 57 through 59, we were not at all concerned about our safety.
Now it seems like a very idyllic sort of
volunteer
experience,
yeah.
whether it's IBS or Peace Corps or anything,
yeah.
or Japanese Overseas Cooperation Volunteers or the British yeah. group or whatever. It's just like the experience you'd like to have.
Yeah. Just
wasn't there a MAG group in Bon Mertuit? I think that was kind of the first sense that there might be trouble. You know, that's a military
assistance
advisory
group.
Yeah.
Yeah.
group or whatever.
Yeah.
Few, maybe six.
Yeah, there were officers.
Like that.
That's how it started in Vietnam,
yeah.
is
mm-hmm.
with the military advisory group, and then of course it escalated. But that was very low key.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and if that was 58, that's even before Green Berets, or
mm-hmm. yes.
which was of course the Kennedy thing.
Yeah, even traveling, traveling on the roads. We'd travel anywhere. There were certain roads that were kind of off limits, but they weren't roads you necessarily had to go.
Uh-huh.
And
were they more remote?
Yeah. And they were sort of along that border, Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos border.
Okay. So they're really interior.
Yeah. Oh yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you could go from Bon Mertuit to the coast without any problem.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
And then there were reports that down in some of the southern provinces there was security problem.
Yeah.
In the delta, and there was an IVS group too. The second group went into the delta area. I don't know if you've interviewed any of those.
Do you know who they were?
Well, there would be Dick Cagle, Gene Myers, you know who else?
Well, we sent Arzela, not we, but Arzela was sent down there,
the nurse.
Okay.
When things weren't going well as far as her work
yes,
was concerned.
Yeah. Give it a try somewhere
yeah,
else.
Yeah.
Par Danforth?
That name is familiar, and Cagle, I think.
Cagle's at Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Madison.
Yeah, I think he's on my list.
Oh, okay.
To see.
Yeah, he worked with well drilling.
Mm-hmm.
He had a very successful program too. He was he had a simple tripod hand well drilling.
Mm-hmm.
Rig that he.
Would you like any hot tea or anything?
No, I'm fine.
Are you okay?
Yeah.
I got Chinese tea.
No, I'm fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So, but he worked in that Kaesong, we call it, Kaesong mm-hmm. area.
This is with the wells with the cement rings.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then a little hand pump.
Yeah.
On top, and mm-hmm. it was a. I would say, as these programs go, one of the more successful ones.
Mm-hmm. So your first 2 years are really pretty good.
Yeah.
Then they made you chief of party.
Yeah.
Oh, then I got headaches.
how
did you get to be chief of party? Were they looking for someone and you raised your hand, or did they seek you out? Or?
No, I didn't raise my hand.
Okay. You were volunteered.
I was volunteered, yeah. I don't know why I was selected. Probably being, I imagine the fact that I was married,
mm-hmm.
and none of the other volunteers were married.
Mm-hmm.
Probably gave me a little more maturity,
mm-hmm.
or at least the perception that there was a maturity. The other thing is, my
and definitely stability in your own personal life.
Yeah. And probably also my background was pretty diverse, and so I could relate to
to various ag programs, certainly. And we were, at the time I was asked to come back, see, that was after 2 year tour, then to come back for 2 years as chief of party.
So did you go home in the meantime?
Yes.
Oh, so you had something at home with you?
Yes.
Good.
Yes.
Good.
Yeah, we came home, we had a second child born.
Oh, second one was born here.
Was born here.
In
yeah.
between, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Better timing.
Yeah. Yeah. And then when we went back, the program had changed considerably.
Mm-hmm.
And we concentrated entirely in agriculture.
Well, before you tell me that, how were you approached, and who was the first chief of party actually?
First chief of party was John Barwick.
Oh, that's right. You put him down as your supervisor.
Yeah, yeah. John Barwick.
Mm-hmm.
He's an older man.
Mm-hmm.
Retired. And
even then.
Yeah. He seemed old to me then. He's about my age. About the age I am now.
Okay, when you knew him then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He seemed awfully ancient.
Yeah.
He was probably 60. I'm 62, so he was probably about that, about our age. They were about our age, weren't they?
Barwick?
Oh, that's hard to...
That's hard to face.
But,
that's what we're laughing at, yeah.
I think the other reason, probably, is that we also went into a somewhat closer relationship with USAID at that point.
Oh, IVS as an organization.
IVS as an organization.
And
or IVS Vietnam as an organization.
Yes, I'm sorry. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, we went there under contract with AID, mm-hmm. and the AID contract was called USOM, USOM at that time. But in the initial stages, there was not very much support from AID.
They probably didn't know what they had to do with it.
No.
It was just too weird for them to deal with. So
we didn't really want to relate too closely to them.
Mm-hmm.
How come? I don't know. We wanted to, you know, work directly with the people.
Okay.
Idealistic.
So it wasn't an aversion to them?
Not really, no.
No, okay.
No.
And it wasn't that you felt like they were crowding you, and so you tried to push them away.
You just wanted
to do your own thing, establish your own identity.
Yeah, add our own, do our own thing, mm-hmm. establish our own identity. That's right.
Because later, when AID did sort of come on and try to take over and give orders, I think a few people did try to push away.
Yeah.
Just because it got uncomfortably close.
Yeah.
I didn't think that that was your case.
Think that's probably another reason why I was chosen to be the chief of party, is that I'm sure that the aid liaison people felt that they could work with me. Because I didn't really have any problems with them.
And felt that we
were a strong enough organization that we could keep our identity and still benefit from some of the great material blessings that they could bestow upon us.
Yeah. Well, they had some bucks.
Yeah,
you know, and you
need
have
shovels,
anything.
We got shovels.
That's
you
right.
You need seed, we got seed. You
yeah.
need a bulldozer, clear land, cement. I mean, these are all things that we had no way of getting otherwise, except with...
I didn't either.
Yeah.
I was in my thing,
yeah.
even though I was more closer to the government than you guys were.
Yeah.
I couldn't get anything,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah. So I felt that that we could work with them and still maintain our identity, and I think we did.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right, there were people that were, I think, very, very concerned that, and more so after I left.
Yeah, because
during
the situation changed.
Yeah, during the time that I was chief of party there, I think our relationship with AID was pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, I think that they supported us, and yet they really respected us.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in fact, they admired the close relationship that we had with the people, and they some of them, quite frankly, wanted to take advantage of that and
mm-hmm.
to get to know the local people better themselves, which was nothing wrong with that.
Mm-hmm.
So, but in later years, that became a problem.
Yeah.
And I think in the years that, in the 2 years that I was working with IVS in that closer relationship with AID, what we did was we began to move the team out into different areas, sort of two by two.
Instead of that cluster of
six
or seven.
Yes, instead of that cluster, and we moved, and we worked with the. They had an ag. You might call it ag experiment demonstration extension research organization there. That is the Vietnamese government did.
Okay.
And they had stations in different areas. In one area it was a vegetable station where they